to another edition of Stormy Weather, news from the front line in the end times. This week I'll be interviewing Adam Gorightly, author of James Shelby Downard's Mystical War, also of The Shadow Over Santa Susana, Black Magic and Mind Control, and the Manson Family Mythos, and The Prankster and the Conspiracy, the story of Jerry Thornley and how he met Oswald and inspired the counterculture, and also Adam Gorightly on death cults. Adam's website is adamgorightly.com.
Hey, Adam, finally.
Yes.
Excellent.
Here we are at long last.
Yeah, welcome to Stormy Weather.
Thank you.
Just, if you don't mind, a little personal history. I don't know how secretive you like to be about this, but
mm-hmm.
I was curious about when you first started investigating these matters and what it was that drew you to them.
I think it all started with UFO sighting I had back in the late 70s. Under the influence of psychedelic, a very paradigm-shattering type of experience, this was in the late 70s, and really how the whole thing unfolded, myself and a friend of mine in a small, relatively small Central California town, under the influence of said drugs, went for a walk one night to get away from a kind of a crowd and loud scene we were at, and made it to a levee, a ditch bank. And before setting foot up on the ditch bank, we joked to ourselves, you know, what if we saw some UFOs right now? In the frame of mind we're in, nobody'd believe us, and we laughed at that somewhat uncontrollably. And it wasn't more than 5 minutes or so later that we saw our first quote-unquote UFO, whatever the heck that might have been. And during the course of about 45 minutes to an hour, we saw in the vicinity of 8 UFOs, and that's UFOs with quotation marks on them because they were all different. Some were the classical-shaped UFOs, you know, the saucer-shaped and the saucer-shaped, but then other ones were almost playful, comical, cartoonish, one with a multicolored propeller. Very seminal experience, one that set me on the course I am today because it made me question everything. And what was unique about the experience, the friend I saw it with, we saw all the same things. You know, we described them to each other, and I suppose we could have been telepathically sending these images into each other's minds. I don't know. You know, and I've entertained a lot of different theories over the years, what it could have been, you know, possible MK Ultra stuff going on and other things. But the explanation that seems the most plausible at this point in my life is that we had unwittingly set a magic ritual in motion. In recent years, I've delivered a lecture at Roswell, the big UFO festival there, and a few other places, most recently at a Fortean conference in Los Angeles. And the title of this lecture is, Were the Early UFO Contactees Ritual Magicians? And I started looking deeply into the history of UFOs and UFO sightings going back to the late 50s and even further, you know, to the things Aleister Crowley conjured. And I'm kind of leaning towards the opinion that magic ritual is deeply associated with the UFO phenomenon.
So when you actually had this UFO experience, then what was your awareness of the phenomenon or of any of these phenomena of occult or of ufology? Were you pretty much unaware of these fields?
Well, no, I was into that whole scene. You know, this was the late 70s, so you know, prior to this experience, we had myself, the friend I had it with, and a lot of my other friends, we had a yearning to have an experience with the other extraterrestrials, you know, whatever. You know, this was the era when you had movies like Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and that was out there to have that experience. And, you know, as far as occult stuff, you know, I read different books. I, at one point, started getting interested, and this is my late teens, early 20s, into astral projection. And so I read a number of books on it, and once again, I had a yearning to astral project, to go into those astral realms and travel other places. And sure enough, once again, maybe this wasn't as unwitting a ritual, but before too long, I actually started astral projecting. And over the course of time, these experiences got more and more spooky, and I felt I had tapped into actually some demonic realm. And at one point, I just stepped back and said, I got to get away from this. And, you know, that basically stopped. I didn't have any astral projection experiences after that. So, yeah, I think this is all deeply rooted into, you know, what they call the magician's intent. I've never been a witting sorcerer. A lot of this stuff has come about unwittingly, and the question might arise, too, have I ever been abducted by aliens? And I have no conscious memory of that, but there was one very realistic dream I had, you know, during the same period. This is, oh, it might have been after I had the actual UFO experience. I was in my backyard. It was summer, sleeping that night on a chaise lounge out in my backyard. Kind of, I was looking, I guess it would be towards the east. All of a sudden, I was in this dream, but everything was the same, you know, my backyard, the chaise lounge, the blanket, the direction I was facing, exactly the same, not one thing out of place. And so as I'm in this dream, reclining in the chaise lounge, looking off to the east, all of a sudden here comes this huge UFO rising above me like something out of Close Encounters, gradually descending toward me, almost a huge mothership type of thing. And as I'm looking at this, I felt a tap on my shoulder, and I jerked to the right, and that woke me up in the exact same place and position I was in reality and in the dream. So I wonder sometimes about all these experiences, if perhaps, you know, and I don't even know if I necessarily believe in a lot of the alien contactee stories as being true extraterrestrials, but perhaps I've been contacted by something that kind of led me along on this path. You know, also with all this, you know, you talked about the occult and the ufological stuff. You mentioned the parapolitical and all, and as all of this was kind of going on in my life, probably in the, I was in my early 20s. I was on a college campus one day, JC here in Central California, and I saw a sign on posted up on college campus billboard, said, did the CIA kill JFK? Had never entered into my reality before that that was a possibility. And I go, oh, that's kind of a mind blower. And so that got me looking into the JFK assassination, you know, which is really the mother of father, whatever, of all conspiracy, a lot of the conspiracy theories that have come after it, that it kind of set the stage, the mechanisms behind the JFK assassination. You see time and again with the Lone Nut killer and these other huge events that seem to bring about a strategy of tension, as May Brussel called it, or the revelation of the method. And so anyway, during that period, I delved deeply into the Kennedy assassination, you know, read dozens and dozens of books. So that got me into looking into conspiracy theories as well.
Well, it's essentially what you're describing with the UFO and the occult, the astral projection and all that. It seems like very much a common experience, I think, is when we, it's like energy follows thought, and wherever we direct our attention, then we stir up, we attract the very things that we're actually looking for, just as Robert Anton Wilson talks about. If we, you know, if you start thinking about the number 23, then you'll spot it everywhere, and it's not enough just to say that you're noticing something that you didn't notice before. It's as if consciousness is actually generating phenomena
that will
match what we're putting out. And that's kind of what you described, isn't it, with the UFO experience, that you had unwittingly performed this ritual by voicing your intent, well, which was to see a UFO, and then actually summon these energies to give you this demonstration. And then with astral projection, I think that's something that is quite common if we just kind of decide. It has been a very innocent way, I think, that it's sort of innocent curiosity. If we actually try to to will these things to happen, then it tends not to work. But when we're in that very sort of pure innocent state, where we're just open to it, then it's like we create this window of opportunity, and that's a window onto the imaginal realm, and then this energy comes through in the form that we've actually decided to give it. So, but then you're getting into conspiracy and parapolitical, and so this is an area that I'm exploring now, is the way that these three different areas of research overlap. And on the one hand, you've got the occult. Everybody accepts, and anyone who's got experience of it, is a very subjective thing, that you're dealing with archetypal energies which don't have any concrete form. They're forces that we give form by invoking and all the rest of it. That's pretty much accepted now. And then you've got the UFOs, and there's sort of divided camps there. There's the literal nuts and bolts, ET hypothesizers, mm-hmm. and then there's the more Kiel Valley, Strieber camp, who go deeper down the rabbit hole, and they'll say, well, okay, that there is some sort of nuts and bolt phenomenon, like even Jung had to acknowledge that these things show up on radars, but they seem to be sourced in some other realm which isn't exclusively nuts and bolt, and so it's not either or, it's both and. You know? And then you've got the people who just won't accept the nuts and bolts thing at all, and it's just purely a psychic phenomenon. And so there's definitely the UFO, it's like the two points of view seem to coexist quite comfortably. But then with the parapolitical, there's very few people, can't think of any really, who are talking about parapolitical phenomena as also being sourced in this imaginal realm also, in the sense that, satanic ritual abuse is probably one of the best areas, I think, because this is very much like the UFO, isn't it? When you look into this, there seems to be all this evidence, and yet there's very rarely is there any actual physical nuts and bolts evidence. And so there's this very mysterious kind of sense of this. Is this an entirely subjective thing, or does it become objective? At what point does it become objective?
Yeah, one parapolitical researcher, in fact, he's kind of popularized the phrase parapolitical as Ken Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you're familiar with his book, Maury Island UFO.
No, but I heard him talking about it on your show, actually, just recently.
Yeah, and so that whole site, and that was actually, they talk about Kenneth Arnold's sighting being the one that really launched the whole modern era of UFOs in 1947, but actually Maury Island happened a little bit before Kenneth Arnold's sighting. Of course, Kenneth Arnold's sightings got more media play at the time, and actually Kenneth Arnold later went and investigated Maury Island, and in recent years, other researchers have looked at some of the names involved, and one guy is this Fred Crisman, who a lot of people believe was one of the three tramps that were possibly behind the Kennedy assassination. He got picked up at the Grassy Knoll. So, you start looking into some of these areas, parapolitical, ufological, the occult, and they certainly do seem to overlap. I was going to mention, you talked about Robert Anton Wilson and how when we tap into these energies or start working on a certain project and you tap into something, and synchronicity often comes into play, and that indeed was the case with my book I wrote on Carrie Thornley.
Mm-hmm.
There was quite a few synchronistic events with people like Wilson and Louise Lacey and a guy named Bob Newport.
Mm-hmm.
So these things happen when you put the energy out there,
Yeah, I was going to bring up Thornley and Robert Anton Wilson, with these areas that aren't clearly defined. They're not part of the consensus. We've just got various clues that we can and threads that we can follow, and from those threads and clues we can patch together a picture. But because it's not in the realm of consensus, there's a lot of room for interpretation, isn't there? It's like we're trying to join the dots without knowing if we've even got all the dots. So in my experience, and I imagine in yours, there's a lot of imagination is required. We need to make sort of imaginative leaps and forge connections that may or may not exist. Before we forge them, we may actually be weaving a narrative as much as uncovering it. Which is kind of like gonzo journalism, isn't it? The Hunter S. Thompson thing, where you put yourself into the investigation, just allow it to be a fully subjective thing and an autobiographical thing. And so I think to some extent, you know, whether we like it or not, when we write about stuff, there's always going to be an autobiographical element. So I'm just curious, you know, how aware you've been in the process of writing the books. You've written Thornley book, which is actually about this. It's about a bunch of pranksters actually creating a sort of meme using elements of real history and so the whole trickster element. You know? And then you wrote the Manson book, which again, there's a lot, there's an awful lot of room for speculation there because the mm-hmm. official story doesn't add up, but we don't actually have the full picture, the full, all the evidence we need to uncover the real story, so we have to be creative. So are you aware of that task in the process of researching these things, of very much being a gonzo creative writer as well as a researcher?
Oh, certainly, and that creativity, I guess, a lot of time is just connecting those dots. You know, with the Thornley book, I don't know how creative I had to be really as far, because I didn't have to make a lot of the leaps in the book. Thornley did that for me. It was a matter of documenting, you know, a lot of his quote-unquote conspiracy theories or his paranoid awareness. With the Manson book, that was the original motivation for writing that. It was over the years I had heard all these theories from the likes of Mae Brussel and John Judge, you know, different conspiracy researchers, David Emery as well, and a few others, that the whole Manson family Tate LaBianca murders were part of some type of MK Ultra or military mind control thing. And so, you know, that was my original motivation for writing those books, was to look at all those possible theories and to see if there was anything to them. And while I have no definitive smoking gun, there were sure a lot of curiosities that came up, a lot of coincidences, maybe, maybe not, during the course of writing that book. And somewhere along the line, I put things into context. I felt I had to really talk about Manson's childhood and paint the whole picture of the whole Manson family story. So it became in time, you know, a 600-page book, which some have said is the most comprehensive on the Manson family. But yeah, it all stemmed from a lot of those conspiracy theories. And incidentally, I'm in the process of updating the book for publication here in 2009 for the 40th anniversary of the Tate LaBianca murders.
All right, so you're still working on it again.
Mm-hmm. Can't get away from it.
Right.
I don't necessarily like being known as just the Manson guy, you know.
But, did you try to speak to Manson at any point?
You know, I'm kind of afraid to. He's not too far from me, actually, as distance-wise. He's probably a couple hundred miles, and I communicate with people who talk to him, and maybe I'll pursue that, really, the way to do it.
Does he have visitors in jail?
I'm not sure if they're allowing visitors these days. That's a good question to answer for my book. I'll look into that. I know people who are in contact with him, they usually start the process by sending him a letter
mm-hmm.
with their phone number. And Charlie will, if he wants, he'll call you back, and I don't necessarily want to give Charles Manson my home phone number.
I don't know. I'd kind of like to get him on Stormy Weather. You know? I was just talking about that today, find out the real story, finally.
Recent rumors are saying that he has lung cancer.
Oh, shit.
So he might not be with us that much longer. Who knows? You hear a lot of these rumors, but there seems to be some substance to this one. A lot of the family members now that are, you know, in jail for the Tate LaBianca murders, you know, they come up for parole every few years, but it doesn't look like any of them are ever going to get out, perhaps. I don't know, there's such a stigma attached to it.
Sure.
The most recent one who tried to get out, pleading for special circumstances, in fact, she had the administration at the prison she was at, put in a plea for her, basically because her medical condition is so bad. It's Susan Atkins, who recently lost a leg and is now battling brain cancer, and they have her in a special medical unit, and she's been transferred to another. I don't have the prison on the tip of my tongue right here, but I don't think Susan Atkins, known as Sexy Sadie, has much time to live either. And one of the people who shot down her plea was our governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger. And curiously enough, there's a recent photo that's out on the internet you could find if you probably plugged in Susan Atkins and Arnold Schwarzenegger into a Google image search engine. It shows a picture of Atkins and Schwarzenegger together back in, must have been the early 80s. Schwarzenegger was making some media visits or something to a prison where they had some type of workout program or something going on. And there you see Arnie and Sexy Sadie together.
Wow. That is curious. Because, as you know, I've written some stuff myself on the Manson thing in Lucid View, and I just found that any lead at all, any thread or any connection at all became significant. It's such a strange and murky sort of imaginal stew that the whole the Manson thing kind of was brewed in, like a witch's cauldron.
It just goes on and on. There are so many connections to the occult world and the rock music industry of the 60s and the film industry and the whole drug black market underground that was going on back in those days, as well as the pornography and possible kiddie porn and these things going on, and even, you know, some very dark ritual magic that, you know, some have contended there was ritual murders involved. And, you know, that's when you get into all these connections possibly to the process church of the final judgment and
Scientology.
Yeah, and Scientology as well. It's just, this goes on and on, and admittedly there's a lot of misinformation and red herrings out there, which makes it that much more of a, you know, rabbit hole to crawl into.
Well, yes, with Masonic Sorcery Theater, there's always these layers. There's the official version, the events as they've been manipulated to create this theater that we are then given by the mass media, and most of us take as exactly what happened. And then underneath that, if we start to dig a little deeper, we find what appears to be maybe the real story, but then it's often just another cover story.
I mean, you know, is there a design behind this? You're probably familiar with some of the history of the Manson family, even before Charlie got out or before the family formed. You know, there was connections there with, we were talking about Susan Atkins before. She was a go-go dancer in the North Beach of San Francisco, and ended up working for Anton LaVey. He had a Witch's Sabbath review, and she played the role of a vampire. There was, you know, so there's a curious connection long, you know, before the Manson family formed. You have Bobby Beausoleil, who is locked up now for what is probably was the first in the Manson family murders, the Gary Hinman murder, you know, prior to hooking up with the Manson family. Beausoleil was associate of Kenneth Anger, the occult filmmaker, prodigy of Aleister Crowley, in fact, appeared as in the role of Lucifer in his film Invocation for My Demon Brother, and later actually scored the film Lucifer Rising. Also in that film Invocation of My Demon Brother was Anton LaVey, who was connected with Kenneth Anger. So you had, you know, all these connections forming prior to the whole Manson family
thing. Of course, LaVey playing Satan in Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure if that is an established fact or not. I've been looking into this recently, too, and I had noted that. I had heard that elsewhere, and I had written about that in my book. Then I've heard other things that was perhaps an urban legend. Then I've recently heard from other sources that it's actually Anton LaVey's eyes that you see in Rosemary's Baby as the Eyes of the Devil, so I'm not quite sure whether it's fact or fiction. That myth is out there. Pardon me? Yeah.
It's part of the meme. It becomes part of the narrative, even if it's not true.
Oh, another rumor or urban legend. Who knows that during the course of filming Rosemary's Baby, LaVey and Polanski had a falling out, and LaVey put a curse on Polanski, which led to the Manson family murders. Of course, LaVey was such a self-promoter that, you know, he wouldn't put it past him throwing something out there just to help publicize himself.
True. So do you think that, I mean, I know Manson's always been evasive about his part in these killings, but has he ever actually out and out denied it?
Yeah, he has. What you're hearing, if you listen to some of his interviews, you know, is that you have to read between the lines, too, of what he says, but that he was set up, he was used as a scapegoat.
Uh-huh.
For, you know, the Manson family murders, and that he had less control of the killers than Bugalosi and a lot of the others said who've created this whole helter-skelter thing. He said that's, you know, that's something the DEA made up, and that's something that the media jumped on, but that isn't how it happened. There is no physical evidence connecting Manson to the murders. He did slice Gary Hinman's ear, but then he left before the murder happened, and I don't think he expected Hinman to be murdered. You know, the argument is that he directed all the thought traffic behind the murders, but he didn't physically participate in any, even though he supposedly got everybody to the La Bianca house on the second night of the murders, delivered them there, then kind of basically told them, you know what to do. Do something witchy, like he told them on the previous night, the Tate murders. You know, this is an ongoing thing there. I've been actually communicating with some people recently that are still looking into this angle that Manson was used as a scapegoat, and it was some bigger operation behind all of this. You know, there's a ton of theories out there that Manson family were being used as a hit team for the mafia, and Charlie definitely had those connections going back to prison. He knew some big mafiosos, like Frankie Carbo was one guy who was a member of a mafia family, and he knew Creepy Carpus, Alvin Creepy Carpus, and all these other characters. So yeah, it's definitely a possibility. A lot of we know La Bianca, and he had, sounds like, some pretty sizable gambling debts to the mob.
Right. Yes, I've definitely heard those theories. But is it possible even that Manson didn't know about the murders until afterwards? Do you think?
Hmm. I suppose it is possible, but you know, from the testimony of the you know, those convicted for the murders, it, you know, definitely sound like he was directing their actions. At least that's the picture they were painting.
Right.
But who knows? Maybe that was all coerced.
Yeah, I mean, if they were programmed through mind control to commit the acts, they could have also been programmed.
It's funny. I was having this conversation with Visigoth today, who you were just on his show recently, and he's actually putting together an interview, and I won't give out too much, but the individual in question, you know, she's just kind of come across this, and she's kind of came to the conclusion that Manson didn't know anything about this, and she's putting the pieces together, and I think we're going to pull together some interview here in the next month or two, and Viz is going to get my take on it, and Andy Colvin, the Mothman photographer, he's done quite a bit of Manson research, and this yet-to-be-unnamed lady who's looking into this theory that, Manson didn't know about the murders and was basically set up as a scapegoat. He's never admitted to doing the murders, and he basically says, you know, it was out of his hands. Can a father direct all the actions of his children? And that he just was brought down with the whole house of cards and used as the ceremonial scapegoat.
The pharmakos.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it does make sense. I mean, because not to already have an opinion about it, but just trying to be open-minded, the Manson's always been a pretty lucid guy, despite the way the media tries to present him,
He
insightful.
has been, but he'll talk in riddles,
Yeah, well, he's
and
definitely the trickster.
and also there's some interviews where one of the most famous is the Tom Snyder interview, and it was obvious that he was drugged while that interview was going on, not self-prescribed drug, but that they had shot him up. Yeah, he definitely looked like he was drugged during that Tom Snyder interview.
Well, because he wouldn't really have anything to lose, would he, by just acknowledging having a hand in it? He's never going to get out of jail.
No, he's not. That's a given. Yeah,
And everybody
that's
thinks he's the devil anyway, so it
the
really
that's
wouldn't.
no, yeah,
You know what I
that's
mean? It
true.
wouldn't really change anyone's opinion of him except a very small few if he actually just came out and said, "Yeah, I told him to do it." That really wouldn't cause any big ripples, would it? I don't think.
Yeah.
So it's curious, significant in itself, I think, that he continues to deny it after so long. It's something that I've been working on ever since I really got into this field, to be honest, but getting closer and closer to it, looking for the unified field theory of paranoia, you
Oh,
might say.
yeah.
And what's behind all these different agendas? And I don't mean in sort of a nuts and bolts way, but in a more subtle way. What's the common theme behind all the different forms of event manipulation, mind control, and media and sorcery theatre and all the rest of it? And what I'm coming up with is it's this idea of what they call crazy making, which is if you can get people to believe something that isn't true, then they have to constantly sustain this false reality to maintain that belief. So they have to keep blocking out anything that goes against this idea they have of reality. And so, in other words, the more things that we can be manipulated to believe that aren't true, the crazier we become and the easier to manipulate we become, because we're essentially getting more and more disconnected from our intuitive sense of knowing. From our potential to just know things instinctively, the gnosis. And so, as long as we're connected to that, we just have this gut sense of what's true and what's false, then it's very hard to trick us and deceive us. But, and so, I think all of this Masonic sorcery theatre and all of this event manipulation behind it all is this common aim, which is to get us to believe things which are not true. And so, the further they are from the truth, the better, also, because that creates even greater tension between our conscious minds, what we're telling ourselves is true over and over again, and what our unconscious is telling us, that no, this is not really what's happening. So we have to cut off more and more from what our unconscious is telling us just to sustain this illusion, this false reality that we're being fed. And so it's kind of like the thing that they want to make us think that black is white and white is black. And so with somebody like Manson, if he really wasn't a bad guy, let's say, okay, he was lying, he had this, but somebody that was a creative individual who was attempting to break out of the box of consensus reality. So it was a shaman, let's say. And this is just a thought experiment. I know I can get into trouble even for suggesting that Manson wasn't a bad guy, but that's kind of the point. We have to believe, and we have to, even if we doubt, we shouldn't even talk about it, because Manson is evil, and that's it. Hitler is evil, and that's that. Don't question these realities, because if you do question them, then you must be sympathetic. You must basically be advocate what these people supposedly, the crimes that they perpetrated. Another thing that comes to mind is the saying in the legal system that any prosecutor can convict a guilty man, but it takes a great prosecutor to convict an innocent man. And so if you take that to an even higher level with Masonic sorcery, that it's very easy to make us believe that Ted Bundy's a bad guy. But if they can find somebody who's basically innocent and manipulate the events around that person so that they're a charismatic leader, who actually are attempting to do something creative to break out of the box, but then they surround that person with operatives and they subtly direct events and then towards this climax, and then of course they set up the main figure, who actually wasn't a player on their team, although to some extent they would have been manipulating him too, as the pharmakos.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. See, a lot of people suggested that Manson was being used by the intelligence agencies in the same way that Lee Harvey Oswald was used. But, you know, Oswald was aware of, you know, that he was working as an agent. He was infiltrating, like, the Fair Play for Cuba committee and putting up this front as a communist. In the same manner, they might have seen Manson. They might have even got to him while he was in prison and saw this charismatic, somewhat talented musician, had this energy about him, and he'd be somebody good to use to infiltrate everything that was going on, the counterculture and the anti-war movement, and basically use him as an agent provocateur to bring about social unrest strategy attention, like Mae Brussels suggested. And Manson said a curious line, and I got this quote from John Judge. Manson said something to the effect, after he got busted on the tape, the LaBianca murders, he wanted to know who was, quote, peeing on his leash, which to John Judge meant that when you get leather wet, it expands, and then when it dries, it will contract, and that's what they did to Manson. They peed on his leash. They let him out and let him do his thing for a couple of years, and they, when they had to set him up for the murders, they reeled him back in and used him as the scapegoat. And so perhaps like Oswald, Manson might have been aware that he was being used, but he didn't see the extent of the, you know, this, how what a grand design it was and what his handlers were trying to bring about, which was perhaps the undoing of the whole 60s anti-war movement and psychedelic movement. John Judge also makes the point that right after the Manson family murders, it was a long time before you saw anybody with long hair or hippies on television. They became verboten, and you know that they were painted as, if you're a long hair, you're a crazy acid goblin knife wielding maniac. The Manson murders came not long after Woodstock. Then you had all these things happen, the Adelmont concert, which was kind of had the same effect of the Manson family on the counterculture, as well as Kent State and everything. These all this stuff kind of came to a head, and it looks like the perhaps the design, if Manson was manipulated, Helter Skelter was designed to bring about a race war between blacks and whites. And who would be behind this? Perhaps the COINTEL program by the FBI. The FBI were basically, even though they were trying to do a counterintelligence thing on the whole anti-war movement, they basically targeted, for the most part, the Black Panthers, and several of the leaders of the Black Panthers were murdered during that period. A lot of times it was self-defense, you know, and it was the structure, the establishment, who brought them down, effectively brought the black movement of that period to an end with all the deaths of the Black Panther leaders. And, you know, before that, Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, you look at all the great and really effective, powerful leaders during that period, they were all killed or jailed. And so, you know, perhaps that was the design behind Helter Skelter. A lot, a lot to chew on there, but, you know, and I guess that's one of the areas you talk about, being a little creative or connecting the dots. I don't know if it's that theory is individual to me. I think other people have suggested that, but, you know, that's one of the areas I've looked into with the book, or at least threw that out there. So I didn't come to any conclusions, but let people wrestle with these ideas themselves and see where it leads them.
Are you familiar with the Dave McGowan's work?
Yes, I am. Yeah, he's looking into the whole Laurel Canyon scene and how it's, you know, that was a hotbed for the rock music industry, and all the movers and shakers lived in Laurel Canyon. And it seems that a lot of them were connected to military families. McGowan suggests that was no coincidence. In fact, Jim Morrison's father was a very high admiral or something in the Navy who led the whole Gulf of Tonkin thing, which really started the Vietnam War. And you look into these different people, and a lot of them, one after another, seems to come from military families. Of course, at the timing's right, the late 60s and backing up 20 years or so, those are people who came out of World War II. But also Sharon Tate's father was a military intelligence officer.
There's one thing I was curious if you're aware of as you're working on the book again. It seems to be connected to my mind is the Jeffrey McDonald case the year later.
Yeah, it had a lot of the earmarks of the Manson family murders, as I recall. The murderers
sure
were kind of described as Mansonoid types, weren't they?
Yeah, they were supposedly on LSD and doing the hippie thing, and basically, and they killed his wife, who was pregnant.
Yeah.
I mean, that was his story. That was McDonald's story, and it was believed to begin with, but then little by little it was discredited, and he ended up being tried and sentenced. He was a captain in the army for the murder of his own wife and family, and he maintains his innocence to this day. So it's got a lot of the earmarks of a psyop, for sure.
Mm-hmm. I know people who are still looking into that, and I suspect that, I don't know this for sure, that he is innocent and that it was a psyop thing. I don't know. That's what my gut tells me.
Yeah, well, same here. But it sort of muddies the water in a sense, doesn't it? Because it was clearly wasn't done in the same with the same intent the Manson thing was done, because if that was a psyop, then, as you've pointed out, it was designed deliberately to discredit the counterculture and to create this meme to strengthen the idea that the hippie was not this harmless flower child, but a psychopathic killer, and it pretty much did it single-handedly. I even heard recently that Manson was actually clean-cut in jail when he first was put in jail, but that they left him in jail long enough for him to grow his beard and sort of groomed him almost to look like the hippie before the trial. Is that true?
If you go to www.charliemanson.com, a guy runs that site by the name of Mark Turner. Somewhere on that site is a picture of Manson, a photo during the time when he was out at Spahn Ranch. It shows basically a short-haired Manson with some other fellow, and Mark Turner is telling me that for the most part, the long-haired Manson you saw, that really happened sort of towards the end, 69 or so, right when they had moved out to Death Valley, around the time just following the murders, and that's when Manson started growing long his hair and his beard. So yeah, he didn't really affect that look until the final days.
So when you said that you would be afraid to contact Charlie Manson, is it particularly Manson, or is it also the, because I'd be more afraid, not so much of Manson, but of his handlers.
It'd be interesting as hell to talk to him. I don't know if I'd get anything out of the interview, but I've never had a driving desire to talk to him in it.
Well, you mentioned that you had experienced microwave harassment, possibly.
Possibly, yeah. And that's probably happened during that period, working on the Manson book, and I'm not saying it's necessarily connected or that I was actually, harassed by microwaves, but this happened probably half a dozen times, four times at home and two times in a restaurant. Interestingly, when it happened in the restaurant, I was sitting at the same seat at the same table, and at home, when it would happen to me, I was sitting on the same place on my couch. Basically, what happened, my body temperature rose. I got very hot. My wife could see it. My face turned a beet red, and I was very uncomfortable. I felt like I was burning up. went on for a few minutes and would eventually subside. And I've read, you know, a lot of the mind control literature and non-lethal weaponry type stuff, and a lot of people who suggest they've been harassed by microwaves have described this same type of thing happening to them.
Well, I remember as a kid reading about spontaneous human combustion, and it was, you know, this bizarre phenomenon. But then later, when I heard about directed energy weapons, I wondered, you know, if maybe they weren't testing them out by satellite or something and just picking out random old ladies, because it often seemed to be old ladies living in homes that combusted for some reason.
I don't. What do you think about my description there of what happened? Does that sound similar to anything you've heard about?
Well, I haven't specifically heard about that experience, but it does sound very plausible to me that if you were going to have microwaves directed at you, you would start getting hot. And a skeptic would say there's plenty of other reasons to suddenly, for a sudden temperature increase, like a fever and whatnot. But assuming that you've experienced ordinary temperature increases, and it was nothing like that, you know?
It's like nothing that's ever happened before or since.
Did it make it difficult to think clearly while it was happening?
Well, yeah, because you're going, man, I'm burning up. What the? That's all you can think about is what's going on here, you know? I mean, it's you're concerned.
You hadn't been researching directed energy weapons or anything like that?
No, I never really have.
Because there was a question that I was going to get around to right at the beginning of this chat, which I never did, which was where I was telling you the occult, the UFOs, and then I was going to ask you if you'd ever experienced something similar in the realm of parapolitical research, where you'd actually unwittingly evoke some kind of phenomena relating to secret government or operatives or mind control.
Well, maybe that was it. Who knows?
I got a couple of, I guess, last questions, but this actually could open a whole can of worms. So it relates to the Manson thing in a sense, which is the whole thing of his history revisionism. And, you know, there's two meanings of the term historical revisionism. One is negationism. Now, that's when you're actually distorting the facts to serve some agenda. And the other is simply parapolitical research, when you're looking at the facts and discovering that not all of them are facts.
Yeah.
So it's a very blurry line, isn't it? Because who's actually saying what the facts are? Well, it's consensus reality, and that's being fed to us by our handlers, by the creators of consensus reality. So they basically decide what's negationism and what's actual genuine historical research. And it's like I was talking about with the Manson thing, that if you start talking about that Manson didn't know and he was set up, then you're risking various accusations, aren't you? Whatever it is you're trying to uncover, it's very easy in today's climate to get labeled.
I wasn't so much concerned with the Manson thing. I think I was concerned that I would be seen as some type of sympathizer. You know, I thought I might get pigeonholed as some kind of fan of murderers, you know. That doesn't really address your question about historical revisionism.
Well, I'm sort of skirting around it, Adam, because it's just such a stigmatized subject. I did this thought experiment at Rigorous Intuition a couple of days ago, and it was basically around the idea of the Holocaust and World War II, and I was saying, you know, what if, for example, Hitler didn't know about the Holocaust? What if Hitler was actually being played, like we've said about Manson?
Yeah.
He was actually had his handlers, and the Nazis were actually mostly were just these Masonic elite who were actually had their own agenda and were using Hitler to push this agenda. You know, I wasn't saying this is what I believe. I was just saying, okay, this is a thought experiment. Let's entertain this idea for a moment. And my intent was not so much what would this mean if it was true, but would people be open to this possibility, to thinking about it? And they weren't. Basically, I got called an anti-Semite. The thread got closed down at Rigorous Intuition, and boom, that was the end of it. My experiment had been very brief, but somewhat effective and successful. I had found out what I wanted to know, which is don't talk about these things, don't question
yeah.
them.
Yeah, it's a slippery slope there.
So there's areas of history, specific
yeah.
areas. I mean, that's obviously the biggest one, and it's so big that it tends to sort of obscure any others, any lesser ones, but there's clearly going to be a lot of other areas. And in a sense, the parapolitical research, it's all like this, isn't it? Because if you get into conspiracy research at all, some wise ass is going to call you an anti-Semite sooner or later. Because
well, there's associations, too, you might have with different researchers and being associated with them. People might assume that you're sympathetic to they're perceived as anti-Semitic. And that might be a wrong perception, too, but that you associate with these
mm-hmm.
different people, then you're an anti-Semite, too. And I'm speaking in particular about Michael Anthony Hoffman,
mm-hmm.
for instance, whose work I can honor. I don't agree with a lot of his views on revisionism, but I certainly am a big fan of his work with James Shelby Downer, and I don't agree with everything Downer put out there, too. I think he definitely expressed some racist views, but is this a reason for throwing out, you know, the baby with the bathwater?
Well, right, exactly. I mean, it's not really a question of agreeing with stuff anyway, is it? I mean, Hoffman, I find Hoffman's kind of philosophical slant very dubious because he's quite anti-occult, isn't he? He's sort of down on the whole idea of practicing magic. And even at one point he says, just go to the Bible.
Yeah.
Just trust the Bible kind of thing, which I found baffling. So, but that doesn't change the fact that there's a lot of good, I won't say information, because who the hell knows what's information these days, but ideas
yeah.
in their perspective. He has a way, he looks at things through quite a powerful lens, and he does see to the core of things in a way.
Yeah, he's a hell of a teacher, you know, but he comes from another vector, you know, and you got to take in all those different angles and mix them up in a pot and come up with, create your own reality or your own lucid view.
Well, exactly. And I mean, if we can't, if there's certain areas we're not allowed to look at and to question, even within the subculture of parapolitical research, then that begs the question, why? Why not? I mean, hold on. Yeah. We know that history has been distorted and fictionalized at every
mm-hmm.
Level. So that's going to apply to World War II and the Holocaust and Hitler. And, you know, Hitler's presented as the ultimate evil. And that
yeah.
in itself, it kind of makes you suspicious, doesn't
oh,
it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Anytime they prop up somebody as the ultimate evil, you're wondering, what's the game going on here? Who's making a profit off of this?
So it's like finding the right context. That's what I've been looking for, is a context in which you can question the Holocaust without it being specifically about the Holocaust. It's just
mm-hmm.
about, let's look at history through this lens of questioning and just see where the cracks are. And if there's areas where we're absolutely not supposed to look, then you can be pretty sure that there must be some big cracks there, because that's the only way to stop us from seeing them, is
exactly,
to make it
yeah.
just too personally threatening. There's certain areas where if you go there, you risk undoing all the good work you've done until now.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of the gist of my question, if you've ever felt that, if you've just ever felt that there were areas as a researcher that it was better to stay away from.
Oh, well, yeah, that area of the Holocaust is slippery slope. Yeah, you're going to be branded something.
But do you find it frustrating? I mean, is it part of you wants to go there just because you're not allowed to?
Oh, personally, I don't know if I've ever had a strong interest to really look into all that stuff, but I'm sure there's other examples. But I've never ran into that where I felt I was going to be ostracized because I'm looking into some specific area that might be verboten. I never got any flack about looking into all the Manson theories, you know, that he might have been innocent or set up. That never registered on anybody's radar where I caught a lot of flack about it. I think that's when I hear comments about my book sometimes, that's one of the areas they praise, that somebody finally really looked into all those different theories and documented them. Nobody ever documented them all in one book before, or even, you know, looked at a lot of the conspiracy theories surrounding the Manson family before in any of the published books on Manson.
How about a book on UFOs, Adam? Isn't that Isn't that on the cards? That was what got you into this in the first place?
Yeah, the lecture I was talking about before, where they called it different things, but it's basically called were the early UFO contactees ritual magicians. I wrote that up in an essay which appeared in an anthology called Dark Lore about a year and a half, 2 years ago, and I'd like to expand that, and actually I'd like to write a book somewhere down the road that talks about a lot of those ideas and my own experiences and the paranormal experiences and altered states of consciousness and different people I've known and some of their experiences and put it all into a book, perhaps call it Untamed Dimensions. That's going to be down the road a few years, though.
So does that mean that you're going to be practicing ritual magic to try and contact the UFOs in the meantime? Doing a little research?
I've already done that.
You're talking about your first experience or other experiences?
Yeah. I don't have a great desire these days to do any intentional... I never really have done any intentional sorcery or magic. I don't want to cross that abyss or whatever you want to call it and play with those energies because they can be unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to open doors I might not be able to close. So I've never really got into any actual practice of magic rituals.
Mm-hmm.
I had enough... success opening up those doors without intending to. I'd hate to see what happened if I actually tried and something went south on me.
Well, sure, yeah. It's like you say, adding the element of intention to things is very risky, but it's also kind of redundant in a sense because life itself seems to be one long initiation ritual.
Yeah.
If we just pay attention.
I'd rather just try to focus and put out some positive energy and keep moving forward, and whatever happens, happens.
Well, on that note, I think I'll let you do whatever it is that you would be doing on Christmas Eve if you weren't doing this.
Yep, I'm not a real traditional guy. But...
For our listeners at Stormy Weather, do you want to give us some websites that they can check out your work?
Yeah, if you go to www.adamgorightly.com, that's kind of like a portal. You can find all of my books there, or at least most of my books. What I'm saying basically is go to adamgorightly.com, which will take it to my blog, and through those two sites you can access all information on my books and podcasts and whatnot. Yeah. Also on my blog I put up posts occasionally if I'm going to be lecturing somewhere or if there's something special going on, a new book. Yeah, I'm doing a once-a-month podcast with Visigoth, and it's a live streaming thing we do over Libertas Media, and it's called The Untamed Grassy Knoll with myself and Visigoth. The last Friday of the month at Libertas Media from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. Pacific Standard Time.
Okay, well, we're getting beeped out now, so
yep.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, thank you.